just grit. And send the ball. You need to know what you are talking about, quite frankly. And I want to say,
compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Cyrus, are you feeling encouraged today? I am.
What?
I'm feeling very encouraged.
Good.
We've got the best callers on this program.
Oh, man, they're so awesome. They're so fun.
It is awesome. 888-914-9149. This is for your Good to Know file. The U.S. has set a summer heat record this year. If you didn't know, it got very hot this past month or so. The U.S. And this is from the Wall Street Journal. The U.S. had its hottest summer on record, narrowly beating out the highs set during the Dust Bowl in 1936. The average temperature for the lower 48 states from June to August was 74 degrees Fahrenheit, or 2.6 degrees above average. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said that the average is just 0.01 degree Fahrenheit above the previous record that was set in 1936. It said a record 18.4% of the contiguous U.S. experienced its warmest temperatures. Five states, California, Nevada, Utah, Oregon, and Idaho, reported their hottest summers on record. And 16 had their top five warmest summers on record, according to the federal agency's U.S. climate report for 2021.
You know what I'm going to call these little segments where you give us cool facts?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to call it Funky Facts.
Funky Facts!
Wow. How long were you working on that one?
Last 7 or 8 hours.
Let me hear it again.
Funky Facts!
All right. I like that.
Right.
There's a little tinkling sound at the end. They get into the drought. They get into the fires. Gets into rainfall above average. Mississippi wettest summer on record, with Alabama, Michigan, New York, and Massachusetts ranking their five wettest summers on record, which makes for a lot of humidities if it's really hot and very rainy. So I just thought you might find that interesting for your Good to Know file. It is what it is. I mean, make of it what you will. And, you know, I'm not here to politicize anything. I'm just saying that's what the weather reports.
Well, someone's probably going to say this tweet that we got kind of stuck in my craw a little bit.
Oh, what was that?
Well, we were talking about a story, and a person grabbed, we were sharing audio. So it was audio of Pelosi or whoever.
And
Dr. Fauci. Well, but it's their audio. But yeah. The person tweeting is like, oh, you guys are just, you know, all you are is right-wing media, or all you are is left-wing media. But we're just using their words.
Oh.
Like, we're not even manipulating.
So when we quote CNN
right.
And at the LA Times and Speaker Pelosi and President Biden and Press Secretary Psaki, if we quote them, oh, Dr. Fauci too, that means that we're, how does that work now?
Well, I guess if we're doing CNN, when we share any story,
they're very right wing, you know, so, that CNN, so, hugely right wing.
So we are just a left wing propaganda machine. But then if we play something from Fox News, we might have gotten the story.
And
from
when
Fox
do we
News.
Ever do that? I mean, when was the last time we played anything? There's a whole war, you know, about Fox News and CNN. I don't want to get into it, but I see your point, though. And it's just an example of somebody being ridiculous, just trying to stir the pot. I'm going to guess, I haven't seen the tweet, but I'm going to guess it was probably not somebody using their actual name.
No, of course not. And
course
they only
not.
Have, they had no followers, and no one's following them. So they went on
right.
there just to harass me. And I'm dumb for even letting it.
Just block them.
Me.
Just
yep.
block them. That's my policy.
Yeah.
If somebody wants to be thoughtful and interact, that's great. I welcome that. But if somebody just wants to take pot shots, just block them.
Bye bye.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to the phones, I must share this story with you. This story makes me very uncomfortable. This is from The Sun. A scorned wife raided her husband's cryogenics lab and stole the frozen brains of people who hoped to be brought back to life. How many people have a cryogenics lab, like in the garage or something? Do you have a cryogenics lab, Cyrus? Anywhere in your house?
No.
Melanie could raid?
I had to get rid of it. Yeah. She wouldn't let me have it.
That was your beer cooler. We're talking about cryogenics, where they freeze brains.
No, I have not had that. No.
All right. Valeria Udalova, 59, and staff from her company grabbed the remains of people who paid thousands of pounds, hoping they could be resurrected. Some of the corpses were from Britain and the U.S. and were stored in Valeria's ex-husband, his lab in the Moscow region of Russia. The lab is Russia's leading cryo storage facility, according to reports. I don't even want to read like the details of what happened, but just imagine that you spent, I don't know, just imagine. I'll spend $50,000. Some of them they got the bargain deal, I guess, for $35,000 for a full body cryopreservation. And you plunk down the money, and after you go on to your eternal reward, they freeze your body or your brain so that you could be brought back to life in due time once the technology catches up with things. We have the technology. And she, in a moment of spite, because they were getting a divorce, she winds up taking all that, and all of those remains are now no longer going to come back to life. That's how I read the story.
We have the technology.
That's crazy.
Okay.
Did you ever hear that? I don't know if this is true or not, and this is totally far left field, but did you ever hear that like Walt Disney had his head chopped off and put in some kind of chamber or something? Is that true?
It could be a wives' tale. I don't know. I mean, I've heard a million wives' tales over the years, and I don't know what's true anymore.
Right.
I don't know if that's true. I really don't.
Yeah, but you had heard that too.
I did hear that.
Oh,
I heard.
Yeah, that's weird. Yeah, what a crazy story.
Well, you know, he may not have the technology, the guy whose cryo lab was broken into, but guess who does have the technology now? And that's Facebook. This is also from a hugely right-wing source, the Wall Street Journal. they have teamed up with Ray-Ban, and they've come out with smart glasses. And these are like way beyond what Google did with Google Glass some years ago. The details are these Ray-Ban Wayfarer glasses have 2 5-megapixel cameras, a 3-microphone array, 4 gigabytes of storage, and a million concerns about the future of wearable technology. Connected camera glasses aren't new. There was Google Glass and more recently Snap's spectacles, like those, the $299 Ray-Ban Stories, that's the name of this one. They are on sale this week. They will let you capture life without holding the phone to your face. These Ray-Bans look normal, but what makes them different is that they're really spyglasses. They have a variety of different combinations and colors. They're powered by technology from Facebook, which has a long history of privacy issues. Executives from both Facebook and Ray-Ban, the parent company, Luxottica, they say that privacy is built into the product. And there are some strong protections. They say that these glasses are intended for capturing spontaneous fun moments like roller coasters and concerts and sports. They are great for those things, but as the article points out, a tap on the small button on the glass's right temple has you now recording videos. So if you are in a Get Smart, what is this? Oh,
hey,
the shoe phone.
Yep.
The shoe phone. Okay. This is way beyond the shoe phone.
Yeah, I guess it is. All right.
Imagine the places that you might be, Cyrus, and if you tap the small button on the right temple of the glasses and suddenly you're filming whatever it is you're seeing or taking pictures.
What could possibly go wrong?
What could go wrong with that? Long press on that same button, you snap a photo. That's where the second camera comes in because there are 3 cameras. For still photos, it gathers depth information so you can edit the photo in Facebook's View Companion app. You can pan around and see some slight movement. There are built-in speakers and a microphone to record what you hear. And lots and lots and lots of storage to store, you know, the video of the roller coasters and sports and things like that. There's no way anybody could ever put these to bad use, is there?
No.
No one's ever going to do anything wrong.
What? People, we should know better as a society. We don't need all of this stuff.
Have you bought your pair of those glasses yet?
Yeah, they're really cool.
And you're wearing them right now. Why do you keep tapping the temple on the right side of your glasses?
Yeah, pretty all soon right. They'll have that where you don't have to touch the glasses at all. You can little button in your pocket or on your watch.
Right.
So there won't be any tell.
Right.
People won't know. And it'll be on your regular eyeglasses. Why don't we just record everything all the time?
The opportunities are limitless. We have the technology. Thank you, Cyrus. Let's go to Barbara in Passaic, New Jersey. Hi, Barbara.
Yeah, hi. When Pope Benedict was Pope, and I'm calling to ask if Pope Francis is still upholding this decision of his, he had gone back to the Code of Canon Law of 1917 and said that he would use that in marriage cases where somebody was Catholic, left the Catholic Church, became Protestant, met someone who was Protestant, got married to that person in the Protestant Church, and then wanted to come back to the Catholic Church because he thought the current Code of Canon Law was so convoluted. Has Pope Francis continued with his decision just to go back to the Code of Canon Law of 1917 in reference to that?
That's a question I don't have an answer to, Barbara. I'm sorry that I don't.
It would be once Catholic, always Catholic.
Right. So let's talk about that, because that much I can talk about with you. The finer details of canon law are beyond my training, so I'd have to refer you to a canon lawyer. Ed Peters comes to mind. He has a blog, I believe it's called In Light of the Law, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And so he would be a trustworthy source if you wanted to look at his blog and maybe do a keyword search. But let's talk about what it means to be a Catholic. So ontologically, when you are baptized, you become a Catholic. You are incorporated into the mystical body of Christ by virtue of baptism. And this is true of even those who are not members of the Catholic Church in any formal sense. Without even realizing it, they have been incorporated into the church in a certain sense in that regard. But as far as Catholics who were raised Catholic, they received the other sacraments of initiation, so confirmation and the Holy Eucharist. They are ontologically Catholic, and as St. Thomas Aquinas said, there's an indelible character that is impressed, so to speak, on your soul, that because it's indelible means it never goes away. So you will always be configured to Christ in the Catholic Church by virtue of baptism and those sacraments. So that much we can say with certitude, and that has, that hasn't changed. The church recognizes that a person who has that Catholic configuration retains it for the rest of his life, even if he turns his back on the Catholic Church and walks away from the Catholic Church. He still has that person, identity.
Mm-hmm. But that person was baptized as an adult in the Presbyterian Church.
Oh, I thought you said we're talking about somebody who was a Catholic and who left the church.
Well, they became Catholic, and then they left the church.
Okay, so that's a little bit of a wrinkle. So let's look at it that way then. So you have a baptized Protestant who becomes Catholic, who receives, I presume, the other sacraments of initiation, right? Who is confirmed,
yeah.
Okay, and then received Holy Communion. So now is a fully fledged member of the church, and then departs and goes back into Protestantism, let's say. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that person, and here's where I can just offer my assumption. I think this is true of the church's law, and that is that the person is still governed by the laws of the church and is still subject to the laws of the church, even if he has turned his back on the church and gone back into Protestantism. That obligation still remains. Am I getting to the heart of your question?
Pope Benedict found that the codes of canon law in regards to marriage in this situation were so convoluted, he just went back to once Catholic, always Catholic, from the Code of Canon Law of 1917.
Fair enough. And I think that tracks pretty much with what I'm saying.
But is Francis...
Well, that I don't know. I don't have an answer for that particular question.
Continue with that, you know, because Francis changed a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, so all I can tell you, Barbara, is on that particular point, I do not know. But if you Google Ed Peters, Canon Law, and look at his blog, again, I think it's In Light of the Law, if I'm not mistaken, you may find a specific answer to that question there. Another place, now that I think about it, is it's an organization called, I think it's called Mary's Advocates, and I want to double check that so that I give you the right address. I think it's marysadvocates.org, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, marysadvocates.org is another website that has a lot of information on these kind of marriage issues. And mm-hmm. I suspect that if there were some change or departure from what Pope Benedict XVI had done, that you would find some mention of it on that website. So mm-hmm. Mary's Helper, marysadvocates.org.
Okay. And what was the name of the canon law person, the first one?
Edward Peters.
Edward Peters.
Right.
Okay.
All right, Barbara. I'm sorry that I wasn't more helpful on that one specific point, but I hope you find that helpful. Thank you. How about Liz now in Maryville, Indiana? Hello, Liz. Hi, Liz. Welcome. Liz is having trouble. Let's see if we can get Liz sorted out. We'll come back to her. Christine in Portland, Maine. Welcome.
Hi. I don't know if I can explain it correctly, but as we know as Catholics, that Jesus is 100% God and 100% man. And I've just been reading through the Bible and it just occurred to me, and so I called you, that at some points it almost seems like maybe it's just Jesus and his humanity. He's a little caught off guard by the behavior of some of these disciples or people, you know, pleasantly surprised by the faith of the, is it the Roman...
He touched the tassel of his garment. Oh, okay. Go ahead.
The one where he says, I know that you can heal my servant. And Jesus said he was amazed by his faith. And part of me is like, well, he's God, so he knows all these things and he knows everything ahead of time. You know, is he just kind of humoring us a little bit, or even in the garden, where he rebukes the three who fell asleep, like you couldn't wait an hour, you know.
Case where the woman with the hemorrhage touched the tassel of his cloak when he was in the middle of a crowd, and he stops and says, "Who touched me? I felt power come out from me." There's another example of what you're talking about.
But he's just a little surprised, you know, and maybe there's a term for this of how he has both, right? He has both traits. And I figured you would know what that's about, and I was just curious. So.
Yeah, sure. I think I know what you're referring to. And if I do, you're referring to what's called the hypostatic union. And that is a theological term that describes what you just mentioned, which is that the second person of the Trinity, God himself, took to himself a perfect human nature. And so in that hypostasis, you have the one person, the Son, what are we doing? What was that? Okay. Yeah.
Siren.
Okay. That was an accident. Sorry about that, Christine. So I'll try to explain it as briefly as I can because we have a break coming. So the hypostatic union means that this one divine person, the Son, subsists in his divine nature, as well as in a human nature. So he is the subject of the human nature that he has taken to himself. Now, you can't, so he doesn't, it's not two persons with a divine nature and a human nature. It's one person. So the human nature of Christ has all those things proper to a human nature, a will, a mind, a soul, memory, knowledge, body, all of those things that are proper to you and me as human beings. Jesus has all of those things. So in his humanity, those moments when you see him either questioning, you know, who touched me, or when he says, no one knows the day nor the hour, not even the Son, referring to himself, these would be examples of Christ emphasizing or referring to his humanity. His humanity is a creature, and it's limited. Now, it's united to the maximal extent possible that any human nature could be, or any human being could be, united to divinity, but it's still an instrument. You might think of it as an instrument of his divinity that is permanently joined to his divinity. So in his human knowledge, he had to learn things. As I've said before, he had to learn how to walk when he was a little boy. He had to learn how to tie his sandals. He had to learn how to do carpentry. presuming that St. Joseph taught him those things. He had to learn how to speak. So this is where it becomes difficult for you and for me, is because on the one hand, in his divinity, he knew everything. Anything that can be known, he knew. But right alongside that was also his limited human intellect, which had to grow and learn and develop. That's the way we do it. So it's hard for us to imagine what was that like, and how could it be that there was some limitation in his human nature that, of course, was not present in his divine nature? And that's part of the mystery of the incarnation. It doesn't mean that we can't know a lot about it, but we can't know everything about it. So in the interest of time, because I have to take a break, let me refer you to a book I love to recommend. It's called Theology for Beginners by Frank Sheed. Have you heard me mention that book before?
I have, and I've read it, but it might be time for me to brush up on it again.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that you read it. That's great. It certainly exercised some mental muscles that you probably didn't even know you had, right, when you read that book?
Yeah.
Took in some directions you weren't
fantastic.
Expecting.
And I recommended it to everyone that I was in contact with at the time, yeah.
That's good.
Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome.
And one more thing before you have a break. Can you pray for my baby? we're 37 weeks. I know you have grandchildren. You have a special place in your heart for the baby. So if you could pray for my baby that he or she does well. We have an ultrasound tomorrow that'll determine what direction the birth will go in. So,
is there any cause for concern right now? Any distress for the baby?
Baby's very, very small, and they're not sure if what that is due to. So,
okay. We absolutely will pray for a little baby, and for you, Christine, and for your husband, the Holy Family. We will pray for all of you, and definitely for that little child, okay?
Thank you so much, Patrick.
You're welcome, Christine. Hang in there. God bless you. I'll be right back. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Okay, we're back. The number to dial, 888-914-9149. We do have some lines open, which is unusual. So grab one now, 888-914-9149.
Hey, Patrick.
And,
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. I just saw an email. I thought you might want to hear it.
Sure.
So this is from Rocio. I hope I'm saying his name right. I can't
remember. How is it spelled?
R-O-C-I-O.
Rocio.
Rocio.
There
That's
you go.
As good as it's going to get from me. All right. Hello, Patrick, he writes. I was listening to the gentleman defending Olson. You
Osteen?
Remind, is it Olstein?
Joel Osteen, is that?
Olstein, okay.
Yeah, probably that.
Okay, yeah, and we were talking about him a little earlier. And so he writes, my opinion is that he is a well-paid charlatan. His charisma helps him convince people to quit their jobs and start selling his books and audio tapes. My sister and brother-in-law lost everything. Even my sister's great job for trusting that man's ideas.
Oh.
Yikes.
That's, wow. Does he say what happened?
No, that's it. That's the extent.
Read that last line again. They lost everything, including her job?
Yeah. My sister and brother-in-law lost everything. Even my sister's great job for trusting that man's ideas.
That's very drastic. I'm sorry to hear that, Rocio. I don't know. Any more details on what you shared, but
yeah, and I think the word charlatan, that's what comes to mind when I think of those type of people. Just be careful who you trust.
I don't begrudge anybody raising funds for their cause. That's not the problem, but where I have a problem, just to go back into that for a minute, and I'm talking more about the mainstream health and wealth, prosperity, gospel preachers, to some extent, to whatever extent Joel Osteen fits into that category, so be it. But my objection as a general principle to that ideological way of raising money is that it sets people up for, and maybe that's what happened in this case, it sets people up for disaster if they don't get what they are promised that they're going to get because they have enough faith, and the person really does have faith of a sort, wanting to please God and wanting to get ahead in life and sending money to the health and wealth prosperity gospel preacher, and doesn't get what he wants, then that leads in many cases to a crisis of faith where people say, well, then maybe, you know, maybe God isn't up there anyway because he's not, I mean, I was told there would be cake. I was told there would be tacos. And then when none of that happens, and then you say, well, did I just not have enough faith, or is it maybe that God isn't up there? And that's a real danger when you take the gospel and you turn it into basically a gumball machine, that if you put in your 25 cents, you're going to get a gumball because God has to do it because you showed that you had faith by giving money. And the gentleman who called earlier, let's be honest, he was trying to make a kind of a backhanded swipe at Relevant Radio's pledge drives. That's what he was referring to. But, you know, that's not what we do. We don't say, hey, listen, if you give us your pledge at $1 a day or more, God is going to give you a new car or a bigger bank account. We never say that because it's not true. And that would be a perversion of the gospel to tell people to be generous with Relevant Radio because God is going to give you the money that you need or a raise or something like that. That's up to God. And only God can make those determinations. And your faith, the size of a mustard seed, is in him, not in the idea that you can get money or a car or something like that. So it's taking a truth, in the case of the health and wealth gospel people, it's taking something that's true and it's twisting it into something that is an aberration of what's true. So to whatever extent any given prosperity preacher fits into that category, that's my objection to it, Cyrus. Does that seem pretty clear to you? Does that seem pretty on point?
I think it's pretty on point and clear.
Okay. I just want to make sure people understand where I'm coming from. Let's go to, where are we going? Gene in the Bay Area. Good morning, Gene, and thank you for waiting. I'm sorry, Joanne. My mistake, Joanne. Oh, okay. I meant Joanne. I apologize.
That's okay. That's okay. Fine. Hi, Patrick. I have been listening to your show off and on when I drive to Mass in the morning. Uh-huh. I'm retired, and I listen to Relevant Radio when I'm in the car. And on this last Friday, I happened to, by God's divine providence, listen to a portion of the rebroadcast of your show on Friday. And the portion that I heard was when you and Cyrus were talking about this show called The Office. I have given up TV for a long time. There's nothing on TV that interests me, that promotes my faith, that helps me have a better relationship with the Lord. So I have not been watching TV. And when I heard your comments about this program and that it had been stopped and now it's going to be brought back, I have to tell you I was greatly disturbed because of the content of it. Even when it was being shown on TV, Patrick, I can't tell you enough. We need to focus on the Lord. We need to focus 100% on the Lord, because things are not going to get better unless we do. We've got to focus on the Lord. He's got to be our main purpose of doing whatever we need to do to stop this craziness that's going on. We've got to focus on the Lord. And that's my plea to you, to please just put God first. We've got to pray constantly. We've got to ask for God's mercy on our country and our world, because things are not going to get better unless we do. And I just want to ask you to think about that when you're talking, because I know you're a faithful Catholic, you and everybody on Relevant Radio, but I just want to say that, you know, please focus on the Lord. Put him number one. And
thank you, Joanne.
That's all I wanted to say.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. God bless you. Let's go to Michael in Bakersfield. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Patrick. I've been listening to you since 2008.
Oh, wow.
And we've spoken.
You're an old timer. thank you.
Yeah, you're one of my heroes, my theological heroes, along with Scott Hahn and all the other guys that do the apologetics. I love you guys. I listen to you. You've helped
thank you.
Me.
Pray for us.
For my oh, always. So my question is more theological, I guess, in the aspects of thou shalt not take the Lord's name in vain, which people just kind of associate with cussing and stuff like that. Rather, the way I see it is these people are taking the Lord's name and profiting from it.
Who are these people?
And I see well, all the televangelists that take all this money and have all these airplanes and all this stuff. And I've seen a lot of preachers that don't take any money for what they preach. And they work, you know, they work at their churches, whether they're Protestant or non-denominational or anything, you know, they're doing what they believe is right, you know, in God's word. But I feel like it's a huge sin to profit from God's word. And I believe that's what they're doing. They see money and they're like, And I know this because one a really close friend of mine, his father was a preacher, and I was talking to him about getting deeper into my faith and becoming a minister or a deacon or something like that. And he was and he turns to me and this guy's a really good guy. He says my dad was a preacher. He made a lot of money, and I just thought that's the wrong reason.
Yeah. So let me look at that through through my lens, if I can. You're raising a good point, and I don't disagree with you that we should not be in a mercenary way. Somebody should not be profiting off. I'm trying to choose the right word to capture, in essence, what I want to say. Now, the Bible does say that the worker is worth his wage, and in a few places it talks about how those who preach the gospel, that they should be paid and they should be, they should have the necessities of life taken care of. So there is a dimension in which for those who are, like, say, priests and bishops, they need to live. They have to have food and a car and health insurance and things. So that's good and necessary, and the Bible even speaks about that. But I think if I had to guess, what you're referring to are the excessive, sort of maybe exploitative way of making use of religion as a way to make money when it's really sort of an empty thing for the person himself. He doesn't care one way or the other, perhaps, but he knows that he's onto something really good because he can make a lot of money by using religion. And this is maybe part of the health and wealth preacher, the prosperity gospel problem. Is that, it's hard to tell whether they really believe any of this stuff, but they know that it works because they can make a lot of money from it. I would agree that that is exploitative and wrong, but I don't begrudge somebody. I'm thinking about, you mentioned Scott Hahn. Scott Hahn is a very gifted guy, and he has written many books. I don't know how many it is by now. It's got to be probably 50, 60, 70 books by now. And he gets paid royalties, and he should get paid royalties because there's a lot of hard work that went into that. And a worker is worth his wages. And I know that you're not singling out Scott Hahn. I'm just using him as a well-known example of somebody whose focus in his professional life is religion. And so here you have an example of a guy who has many best-selling books, and he receives a royalty on them. And probably, I would think anyway, just given how successful his books are, I would assume that the royalties are quite generous and quite handsome. And I think that's good for him to do that, or any author. And you can extend that into the world, not just of books, but of other things as well. So my thinking about this, because I am an author and I do write about religion and I do receive royalties from the publishers on that, my view is to say it's not exploitative or it's not mercenary if this is what you do. Let's say as an author, and you were compensated for it, just like if you worked, you know, in some corporation, you were compensated for what you do. There's a right way to do that and a reasonable way to do that. And then there's an unreasonable way to do it, where you're just simply turning the faith into a profit center and nothing more. It's just a way to get gain. So am I understanding your point correctly, Michael? Is that the distinction that you're making between the two things?
Oh, yeah, totally. You know, people have their heart in it, and they really want people to know Jesus, and they're working towards that. Is a whole different ballgame than the guy that just, he's all, hey, doing this Jesus thing, I could make a lot of money. And they don't, you know, necessarily believe in Jesus, or maybe they even do. But their whole goal is the financial gain, not the salvation of souls.
Right. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. There was a guy in the book of Acts who was a magician, and he came to the apostles and asked them, can you please show me how you do this, and I'll pay you if you can show me how you do these things. And they sent him away because
they
rebuked him. Right, they rebuked him. Because the gospel is not for sale. The gospel is not something that you can peddle. You know, he thought they were doing tricks, magic tricks or something. And he didn't realize that this was the power of God.
Yes. So, yeah, I was trying to relate it to also, you know, the commandment, thou shalt not use the Lord God's name in vain. And you know, and how does that, you know, play out?
I see what you're saying. So in other words, if they're invoking God and they're saying all these things that will happen to you, money that you can make and such, I can see, I don't think that's directly, you know, the commandment to keep holy the Lord's name, but I could see that as a kind of extension of it, where they're turning God, his name, the idea of God into kind of a carnival sideshow. I could see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Michael, thank you. Interesting topic, no doubt about that. Certainly touched a few nerves, the Joel Osteen issue, for better or for worse. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back with more of your questions and comments right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
We're back. I was expecting the lady to say something else, but I guess she's not. Let's go to Joe in Downington, PA. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to quickly say thank you. I had called about a year ago and asked a question whether to attend a friend's wedding. He's Catholic and did not get married in the church. So his wedding was this past weekend. I ended up not going. And I just wanted to say I know you get a lot of these questions from other callers. How small a price is that to pay for our Lord? And how telling is it for the people who you decide not to go? Like for those people who turn you down or no longer speak to you, like my friend is now, how telling is that of your friendship? So I just wanted to say thank you for giving me the guidance, and I've come to realize how small a price that is to pay to lose a friend who clearly does not respect our friendship enough to stay friends when you share your beliefs with that person. So if somebody had come to me and said, you know, my deep convictions are I can't do X, Y, and Z with you because of my faith, I think it would be fairly easy for me to respect that person who clearly respects our friendship enough to tell me something like that. So I just wanted to say thank you because I did end up not going. I think it cost me a friendship, and I don't have any feelings of sadness over that. I just feel like it was a small price to pay for all that our Lord has done. So I was happy to stand up for the faith.
God bless you. I'm sorry to hear that it ended up that way. Sometimes these things do. What I hear you saying, Joe, is that you sort of now have the measure of the friendship as it really was, as opposed to what you thought it was. And if something like that was sufficient to just have him turn his back on you, then now you know that he wasn't really that much of a friend, was he?
No. And the interesting thing is my wife had the same situation and it played out the same way. So we both have been looking at each other like, wow, that was very indicative of the level of friendship that those we had with those people. So
interesting. You know, I wrote a book. I don't know if you've read it or maybe you've heard of it, but it's called Life Lessons, 50 Things I Learned in My First 50 Years. And I have a chapter in that book. Each one of the chapters, they're all very brief. And each one is kind of a reflection on something true that happened to me in my life. And I wrote the book primarily for my children and grandchildren so that they would know me after I'm gone. And I have this one chapter called The Friends. And in that chapter, I talk about this phenomenon of how Nancy and I, you know, we would make friends, and then after a while, they would just sort of drift away. And I might read that. It'll only take a moment to read this, but how about that, Joe? Just kind of in response to your comment, I'll just read my own reflection on that issue from this book. Would that be okay with you?
That'd be perfect. And I had a quick question for you. Do you have time for that? Yeah, go ahead. So this is just a specific question around confession. I was in line at my parish for confession a couple months ago, and the priest had to end his confessions because he had 5 o'clock mass to get ready for. And when he left confession, he gave everybody still waiting in line, including me, a dispensation to receive the Eucharist, which I was, to be honest, just confused by. And I just wanted to get your take on, is that even allowed? I mean, I would imagine there's people in the state of mortal sin in line.
No. Now, outside of a unique and unusual situation like the imminent danger of death, in which case, even still, a priest could still have a few moments to hear someone's confession. No, that's an abuse that's an abuse. The church's rule is if you are aware of being in the state of mortal sin under all but some really unusual circumstances, and this wasn't one of them, then you have the obligation to make a good sacramental confession before you go to Holy Communion. So you just defer going to Holy Communion until you've done that. And so the priest does not have the right to grant you a so-called dispensation to do that. It's unfortunate, to say the least. Well, Joe, thank you. I appreciate it. So here's this brief reflection on what Joe was talking about with regard to friends. And it comes from a book that I wrote called Life Lessons. Early in our marriage, Nancy and I enjoyed meeting new people with whom we developed friendships, though we started to notice that most of them didn't last very long. It was weird because though we seemed to have plenty in common with most of the young couples our age whom we befriended, you know, same parish, similar interests, kids, etc., it seemed that after a few months, maybe a year at the most, things would begin to peter out. The invitations for dinner or backyard barbecues became less and less frequent, as did the phone calls. It eventually dawned on us that unless we made the initiative to call or get together, nothing would happen. Was there something odd or off-putting about us, we wondered? Had we done something to offend? That was certainly possible, we figured, at least once in a while here or there, but regularly? Come on. Perplexed, Nancy and I even began to experiment to see how long it would take for the now familiar trend to play out. How long it would take for a formerly warm and promising acquaintance with another couple to cool and evaporate. Consciously observing the process didn't make it any more comfortable for us, but we gradually became less puzzled. What we learned together, and what I've learned in my own way personally over many years, is that what we initially mistook for friendships were really just friendly, comfortable acquaintanceships with congenial, attractive people with whom for a time we had enough in common to generate some fun times, a few laughs, and not a whole lot else. We discovered that virtually none of these shiny, happy people were actually our friends. Back then, neither we nor they really understood what true friendship is and why, though it's certainly pleasant to hang out with fun, interesting, like-minded people, true friends are actually pretty few and far between. It is true, as C.S. Lewis famously said, that friendship is born at the moment when one man says to another, "What? You too? I thought that no one but myself, ... Some of my own dearest lifelong friendships sprang into existence on the occasion of similar realizations. Even so, as I came to see, a true and lasting friendship has something durable and resilient about it that enables two friends to weather not just the storms of life, but also the monotonies, geographical distance, hectic schedules, and the myriad mundane cares of life, all of which are quite capable of stifling a growing friendship with simple inertia or inattention. That's what Nancy and I didn't understand about our friends early on. They were busy, we were busy. Time marches on. And though the fun times were fun and all, Fun isn't sufficiently deep soil for the roots of a true friendship to sink down, take root, and thrive. And once this simple truth came into view, hazily at first, I started learning the true meaning of friendship, which made it easier to recognize a real friend when I found one. I've always loved this description. True friendship does not consist of two people standing face to face gazing at each other, but two people standing side by side gazing in the same direction. What I learned was that kind of friendship, everything from man and wife in holy matrimony to members of a band of brothers and every other type in between, enjoys permanence and stability when it is grounded in a common goal shared by the two. The more noble and beautiful the goal, the more noble and beautiful the friendship. I say, now I can see clearly what was nearly invisible to me when I was young. True, good, and lasting friendships are relatively rare, and that's good. It's fine to have many acquaintances with whom you can share a laugh or a meal, but a true friend is a great treasure, well worth waiting for. I'm thinking with profound gratitude to the Lord of those few lifelong friends of mine whom I treasure. So there's my contribution to the question about friendship from personal experience. Let's go to Rhonda now in Dubuque. Good morning, Rhonda.
Good morning. My question is in the Bible, in Matthew chapter 5, verses 43 through 48, it says, love your enemies. So my question is, I am a forever optimist, and I sometimes pray that God will send grace to the devil to change his heart. Is this a sin on my part? I truly want to do whatever the Lord wants me to do, and I don't want to be doing something sinful.
Oh, my. That is so beautiful. Your sentiment is beautiful, and I'm sure it's very pleasing in the eyes of the Lord. Now, in the case of the devil, it's worthless for you to feel that way because the devil can't change. And here's why. There are two reasons why. One is the angelic nature itself, which is different from us. Angels, as pure spirits, they perceive anything and everything that they are given to know immediately. And so their knowledge and the decisions that they make on the basis of their knowledge are immediate and irrevocable. So unlike human beings, you and I can, through trial and error, we can make mistakes, we fall, we get back up again, we fall again, we get back up again. The angels are not like that. So their very nature, it doesn't accommodate that kind of change of heart. They're permanent and fixed. The second reason is that in eternity, which it has a lot to do with the angelic nature, but in eternity, your decision for or against God is also permanent. So in time, which we live in this earthly life, we have the opportunity to do, as I said a minute ago, to fall and get up again and fall and get up again. Angels don't have that opportunity, nor do human souls after death. So those who are among the blessed, who will be in heaven forever with God, their decision for God is permanent. It's definitive. And it will never change. And the same is true for the souls in hell. So what I find beautiful is that you have a lot of charity in your heart, Rhonda. And even though it's misplaced in this case, it's still a great thing that you're seeking the reconciliation of everyone who can be reconciled with God, that you're seeking that. That's a good thing. But in the case of the fallen angels, don't waste your time because it's impossible for them to change in any case. Does that make sense? Do you see what I mean?
It does. It does. And my prayers are often like a Jenga, the game Jenga. And I will take that piece out. You know, you can slide the pieces out and put another one in. So I will just find another person that needs my prayers, and I will put them in place of the devil.
Right.
So thank you.
And your prayers are not wasted. God will apply your prayers.
No. Mm-hmm. No. Thank you so much.
Right. Thank you, Rhonda.
That.
God bless you. Let's go to Martin in Skokie, Illinois. Hello, Martin. We're short on time, but welcome.
I know. I'm trying to study specifically about, like, apologetic about abortion and defending Holy Mary being Mother of God and Holy Eucharist. Is there such a thing, or apologetic usually general?
Well, apologetics, there are apologetics resources on all of those topics. I have written widely on those, with the exception of abortion, which I have not written about. If you're interested in apologetics on Mary and the other issues that you mentioned, go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, and you'll see where it says links, and you can click one of those links that'll take you to the books that I've written. And I've covered all of those topics in my books with the exception of abortion. But on abortion, Catholic Answers has got a very good book. It's called Persuasive Pro-Life, and their website is catholic.com. But I would encourage you, if you have a Catholic bookstore in the area, go there first and buy it from them if they're open. And otherwise, you can get it online. But those are all available to you. Their website, again, catholic.com. And if you want to see my books, just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick and click on links, and you'll see them there. I think we're about out of time, it looks to me. I don't think it would be possible to put another... Yeah, there we go. There's the music. So we'll pick it up again tomorrow, same Pat time, same Pat channel. My thanks to all of you who listened and who called in today. Thank you for that. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow. And until then, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.
Man's got to know his limitations. Yeah.